I think it's been fun to see that restaurants have actually sort of handled this the best out of any businesses. Not necessarily.
But I think, but they also, they had to, right?
Because they did, like,
because people don't have to go to restaurants.
Yeah. Yep.
So a restaurant
really
had
want to, though.
Yeah. A restaurant had to make you want to go in spite of the fact that, you know, you might die.
Right. Scotch. Shenanigans.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 310 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and my caffeine has not kicked in.
Oh, I'm Sam, and I just went for a walk.
Do you hear how slow I am right now? It's like molasses.
You'll speed up. You'll get there.
I think it'd be fun if we could have Patrick just like slowly speed up Adam's speech over the course of the episode until he's just going a mile a minute.
Well, he'll get desynced. We could just raise the pitch, maybe.
Yeah, that'll
maybe
work. Just kind of. It'll sound like I'm going faster that way.
Yeah, and also this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is May 6th, 2021. Dunk on everyone. And before we get started, we have a warning. There will be profanity in this show. And we'd also like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. We got a donation from Michael Salvage,
who says,
old buddy of ours, who says, I listened to episode 12 today, and I learned way too much to fit here. So please reference my tweet if you're interested, because it's a formative episode. Wow. So he put a link. So I checked it out, and he had a bunch of hilarious notes in here.
Was this Pint of Lizard Kingdom, or was that 13?
I think it was 13.
Yeah.
I might be right.
But it's pretty interesting, his takeaways. Apparently, we had some pretty good forecasts in there, particularly that once we launched Crashlands, it was going to be 2 months of hellish patching and bug fixing. which was true. It was a little bit of an underestimate.
It's one of those weird things where, you know, when you estimate something that's going to be terrible for yourself, and then you're like, that's just how it is.
Yeah, how could it be any other way?
Years to prepare and make it not that way, but I guess here we are. Yeah.
Yeah. And he had one other really interesting insight that I hadn't thought about, which was around that time, we had gone to do an interview here in St. Louis at a radio station.
Oh.
And he's like, I wonder if that's connected to you guys suddenly deciding to improve your audio quality, right? Because like we went into an actual professional studio and saw how they were using their mics and what the setup was and stuff, right? And then suddenly after 11 episodes of our podcast sounding like garbage, we, you know, turned around the audio quality.
We turned around a little bit. It wasn't until I think like the 50s or something where we – like really turn it
around. We didn't turn it around, but we did sort of angle it.
We just got a little closer.
So thank you, Mike. And also thank you to our recurring supporters as well. All right, let's talk about what's going on in the world. Namely, you know, this pandemic that we've all been living through is, well, we're starting to get a handle on it in some sense. We're getting our vaccines. I am fully vaccinated. Sam's fully vaccinated. Adam just got his second dose a week ago.
Yeah, almost.
Yeah. So it
was last Thursday.
Yeah. Yeah. So he is now halfway through his 2 week sort of ramp up period to becoming immune. Well, not immune,
as we discussed,
fully vaccinated.
Fully vaccinated. As immune as possible.
Yeah. Immune-ish. Mm-hmm.
That is kind of a problem, right? Because like immune means literally impervious, but your immune system doesn't make you literally impervious. Right?
You still get the stuff in there. You might get a cough. You might get a little fever or something.
Yeah, so we should call it your immune-ish system.
Immune-ish. Yeah. Yeah. It's your disease slappers, you know. It's still in there, but you're going to slap it around more than you used to. So it's been kind of interesting, as we talked about a couple episodes ago. Sam was traveling for the first time in a year and a half, hopped on a plane.
Yeah.
Let's talk about it.
Yeah. So I think it's interesting coming out of this year of, not really going anywhere. Just sort of like being on a plane again, it's a reminder of just one. It is a magical thing being able to just, you know, fly as a human being. pretty fucking wild. And it's one of those things is you're reminded of it when the sort of in the, you know, the constancy of like every couple of months taking a trip somewhere for business or whatever else kind of goes away. And so there's definitely that angle. There's definitely a big feeling.
It is funny how they took what is a magical experience and then have just slowly over the decades drained every ounce of magic out of the actual experience.
Oh, yeah. It's a barely tolerable magic experience. You know, it's kind of like when Harry Potter uses flu powder or whatever, and everyone, like, when you come out of the other side, people are just kind of like fucked, like disoriented. They're like, what? You know,
because the fact that you are rocketing through the air at 500 fucking miles per hour, but it feels like you're just in sort of like a dank bus. Like, you know, a little more pomp and circumstance would go a long way here, I think.
It'd be appropriate. It's kind of the same way I felt about getting the vaccine in the first place, as we talked about. Like, no pomp and circumstance when you get your shot. They're just like, sit over there, whatever.
Sit over there, wait, all right, get out of here.
Yeah. So, but there's definitely a feeling of just like too many fucking people, right? Just everywhere. Because like as soon as you're in public spaces and now that people are starting to emerge because, you know, people are – a lot of people get vaccinated. I think the country's at like over 40% now or over 50%.
Actually, I think we've hit 50% who've had at least the first shot.
Yeah, which is awesome, right? But that means there's like just a lot of people out and about. And so there's definitely that feeling of like just walking around. It has been a while since there's been crowds that have been in, let alone like sitting next to people on an airplane. What I found interesting about it though is actually the mask, like sort of mask on and off stuff, which, you know, there's – we didn't really go outside during the whole pandemic. So there's that whole group of people who are complaining about masks, right? Like, oh, it's so much. Oh, it's so annoying. Get it off my face, whatever. I know it's a whole other related thing. But as far as like just being able to like flip a mask on your face and off, you get used to it like really fast. Where I just had one in my back pocket. We'd be walking in the street. If we saw someone coming up or like a group of people, just
slap it on.
Just slap it on. Yep. Walk on by. It was like no big deal to the point where like, I would just sometimes be wearing a mask and I didn't even know that it got on there. It's sort of like a, you know, it's just still on there. Like you put it on a while ago. Sort of
it's like a hat. You know, you just put it on. Yeah, put it on when you need to get the sun out of your eyes.
The key is to have a comfortable one, you know, and all that. Because, of course, if you have like an uncomfortable thing that's – and also you have to have a way to store it easily, right? Because a good mask will have a, you know, metal piece for your nose so you can conform it to make it more airtight. And that means they're hard to fold up. You know, I actually just got a carabiner or whatever you call those little things, you know, and to put on my belt loop that I can loop my mask on. So there's just there. And I can just be like, put it on, take it off, whatever.
Yeah, we'd carry ours around.
The modern pandemic man with his carabiner mask loop.
Yeah, so I found it actually very, very easy, to be honest. Like once you get over the first couple of minutes, it's just weird, like being in the airport, being on a plane. But then it's just the same shit. And then you're wearing a mask, which weirdly enough is kind of nice because it's like you don't have to worry about the bottom half of your face in public.
Well, not only that, but like remember – okay, just think about this. Whenever we talked about going to GDC or conventions in the past, we're always like somebody's getting sick.
Yeah.
Somebody's getting sick,
well,
right?
Somebody of us, but we also meant literally like 50% of all people.
Yeah, I mean every fucking GDC, there's a flu that just rips through the entire convention. Yeah, like half of the game developers in the world are just shitting for
it. Which is actually because we talked a lot about the impact on our studio, right? Where we're like, oh yeah, we're gone for a week. We spent all this money, right? And then we come back and we're just exhausted and at least one of us is sick. But now you multiply that out across – the whole fucking games industry, right?
Yeah, this one convention is like knocking $1 billion of productivity out of the games industry at least.
Easily. And does it make it up for it? You know,
it's hard. It's like I'm going to wear a mask when I'm flying now.
Definitely.
No matter what, you know, and I might even wear one at conventions.
I think I will.
You know?
We need to get some rad like B-Scotch branded masks for going to conventions, you know?
Yeah, and like I love this. I love this because you know what I hate? Being sick.
Yep.
And if it comes from just like people breathing their weird stuff into my mouth, which I'm also not a fan of just conceptually. What I think is kind of weird about this is where people have decided to draw the line about what counts as an infringement on their freedom, you know? Mm-hmm. Because like if you walk up to a convenience store and they're like, hey, you got to wear shoes. And you're like, yeah, of course.
That tracks.
Of course I will do that. Even though they have freshly mopped floors, maybe.
Yeah, because why would you, have to, actually? Like, what?
Why would you have to? Mm-hmm. Right? And, like, you gotta wear a shirt. It's actually
probably a liability issue because, of course, there's, like, broken glass and you step on it and then you see the store and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, or, like, you gotta wear a shirt and you see that sign and you're like, yep, I will – you know, or maybe you were at the beach and you see that sign. You're like, ooh, crap. And then you run out to your, you know, run back to your car and throw your shirt on or something. And you walk in there and it's no problem.
Or you go to a really weird beach. The beach is like, you have to wear shoes here. And you're like, oh, no, this is the worst. That's actually the worst at that point. Like, I would. That's
getting
sand. Now my freedoms are definitely being impinged.
100%.
You couldn't get to put sand somehow, in the shoes. Yeah, and somehow, you know, we've all agreed to wear pants in public. We've all agreed to wear shoes. We've all agreed to wear shoes and shirts in establishments.
And if you haven't, there's a place where you can go. It's called a nudist colony. You know?
You just,
bunch of like-minded people get naked. And and it's fine because you just do it with each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And interestingly, you know, we accepted all of those mostly because we're just not super interested in, you know, seeing other people in that state while we're getting our gas filled up or whatever, right? Yeah. But it's not a health crisis if somebody walks into a gas station with no shirt on.
Right.
Right. Like, people probably won't die from that. Probably.
Probably.
But somehow.
But people might, you know, lose their eternal soul.
Yeah. They might have their soul sucked out of their body.
Yeah. Probably, I mean, it's likely because, like, you know, the United States is a really puritanical rooted, like, culture with all of its weird ass views of sex and all this kind of stuff, you know? So probably this all is like the difference between covering your body, which is an evil vessel, right? Mm-hmm. It's literally evil. You got to cover it up as much as you can. So we've all accepted this because it's been true for hundreds of years.
Keep those nipples on lockdown, okay? Yeah.
But your face is what you use to adore Jesus. Or
something. I don't know.
Is that true?
I don't know how it works. But the fact is, like, it's so easy to just slap a mask on. And compared to many of the other rules that we've all just happily agreed to follow, this one actually does something pretty important. I'm just going to be doing it.
Well, I will say, actually, it's one of the few things that does something very important for you personally, especially in airline travel, because it's also the case, like, usually when I travel, I'll have like a little cold or something when I get back. Didn't it all this time, you know, because I was wearing a mask the whole fucking time. And I was like, actually, this is great.
I think in the same way, like, I haven't had the flu in, because I've gotten a flu shot every year, And when did flu shots even start to exist? Like, I don't remember there being a time when I wasn't getting a flu shot, but
getting them.
I've gotten it every year. And the last time I got like the actual flu, like, must have been more than a decade ago, you know? It's like, I don't worry about the flu now, but if somebody has it, I stay the fuck away from them, right? Because I don't trust the vaccine that much, and you shouldn't, because the flu changes so fast that every year it just has random efficacy.
Again,
right?
It still has to get in you care of it. You know what I mean?
So you still don't want to fuck with it on purpose, right? Mm-hmm. But like, I haven't had that, but versus colds, which there was a period of time where I was getting, like, during the winter in particular, I would get a new cold every fucking like 6 weeks, you know? And unfortunately, it's not been that bad now for some time, but it still is the case that basically every winter, at least once or twice a year,
you're getting a cold.
I'm getting an aggressive cold.
Mm-hmm. But somebody gave it to you. You didn't just get a cold just because it's winter, right? Like somebody put their mouth droplets into your mouth. somebody sneezed into your nose holes from a distance, of course, but still. So that's been kind of interesting.
Yeah, well, the general effect there of traveling again was one of those, like, oh, okay, it definitely makes you feel, honestly, it does go a long way to make you feel back to, like, that state of what you call, quote-unquote, normalcy, right? Because it's just one of those things you couldn't even think about for so long. So that was really nice. It's got that feeling of, like, oh, if I really needed to, I could go do stuff. But I'm still very much on the page of, like, I don't really want to go do most things, you know what I mean? Like, it was, the lockdown was nice, I think, for a number of us in a number of ways, where depending on mentally kind of what you're up to, like, just sort of the stripping away of a lot of the social obligations is kind of like, it can be kind of nice, can be clarifying and give you some space to breathe, you know? And so I think depending on who you are and kind of how you felt from what would either be the isolation or solitude that something like quarantine gives you, kind of determines how you're going to feel about coming out of the quarantine haze. You know, it's going to be a little weird.
It's going to be weird. We got some new waters to navigate. And I can also say, because my wife's getting her first haircut in, since last February or something. And she was like, yeah, my hairdresser's just booked. I was like, this is like the great shaving of 2021. Like, there's going to be so much hair on the floor of these salons. They're going to be sweeping it up. They're going to have like an industrial vac trying to get it all collected. Like, my God.
Yeah, I think it's
everybody is so hairy.
Yeah. Yep. I think like, because I need to go to the dentist now, you know, and pretty quick, I'm going to go make that appointment finally. But most people like haven't those few of us who like do the whole, like you're supposed to go every year. And so we do, cause we want to make sure our teeth don't fall out of our heads. You know, I'm not sure how common that actually is as a behavior, but that was drilled into us literally. since we grew up, you know? But I haven't been now for a year and a half or whatever it's been. Cause I hadn't been right before the pandemic started, cause I didn't know when was going to start, you know? And so just like, so late, but yeah, everybody else is too. Says they're going to be like a big backlog where just all of a sudden, like everyone's getting their teeth there all scraped up. You know,
I was just there on Tuesday morning when I got my teeth all cleaned up, and they were like, one, your teeth are in pretty good shape for having not been to the dentist for basically a year and a half, right? Because it's like Adam was saying, the timing was such, right?
Did you ask them, then what are you even for?
I did. I was like, I mean, I'm going to be honest, you're not selling your services very well right now.
Yeah.
Every time you look into someone's mouth, you'd be like, oh, thank God you're here. This is a cesspit. You were headed.
Well, you got here just in time. Two or three more days of this and you'd probably have no teeth left.
Disgusting. Yeah. They weren't really selling their services very well. But I did ask him. I was like, is it the case that everyone is emerging, you know, and you guys are getting booked up? And she said, yes. It's starting to it's almost like the tap is being turned back on, sort of a thing, right? Where it's like people are suddenly starting to come back, and there's going to be a backlog for all of that.
Yeah,
like,
and actually, this is one of those things that if you were able to manage your processes really, really well and adapt, because we've seen one of the interesting things about the pandemic is watching various businesses and industries adapt or not adapt, right? Mm-hmm. And then plan or not plan for what's going to happen once things start to open back up. Because imagine if you were like a dentist where, you know, most people just need their teeth cleaned. That's like the main thing. Yeah. And then a quick check, as I'm sure we've all experienced. We go to the dentist. It's like some person goes there and just like scrubs your teeth a fuckload. Right. And then the dentist comes in, like looks in your mouth
at it,
and then they walk out the door, and that's the whole thing.
That's a good mouth.
Mm-hmm. That's a good,
in 6 months.
Right? And there's a bunch of just kind of like sitting waiting around in between all these things. Right. Like if they streamline the shit out of that process and we're just like, okay, Mondays through Wednesdays or whatever are just rapid teeth cleaning and that's it. And they're trying to like just pump people through the system, right? Then they could probably actually catch back up with all the pent up demand, you know, and like actually get people through the door and then actually have it so that the overall impact of having gone through the COVID quarantine might not actually be that bad, right? Mm-hmm. But it requires being able to adapt and plan around the realities of that. And I think it's been fun to see that restaurants have actually sort of handled this the best out of any businesses. Not necessarily.
But I think they also – they had to, right?
Because they did, like,
because people don't have to go to restaurants.
Yeah.
So a restaurant had to, though. Yeah. A restaurant had to make you want to go in spite of the fact that, you know, you might die.
Right.
But I mean, like, so you got to be like,
started doing online stuff, you know, like all of them that previously – did. And when I was out for a walk yesterday and went by, there's a little pub kind of a few blocks away, and they just have an awning with a door that's like they've converted. It just used to be a door. They converted it into one of those like top half, bottom half doors that both open separately, you know? And so the top half is just open and it's just their like online pickup window, you know, with like, they put an awning out on the street so that people don't have to come in at all, you know? Like, but this is all stuff that they actually like thought through and did.
Yep. Now, I do have to give a shout out to Kate Zone here in St. Louis.
Because it's the best restaurant or
for – Because they did not adapt.
No, they did not.
Because they don't give a fuck.
And they didn't
Because they
to.
Know. They're like, no more in restaurant dining, but we're not hooking up to Grubhub. We're not like, if you want our food, you come and get it, right? And it was like, people did.
Yeah, everybody still
did.
Because
it's so good.
Yeah. So, whatever, so like, you
that's
say,
another – Yeah. I'll That's another it. Strategy, right? Just like make food so fucking good that people just will come.
People
and
will
get
go
it.
Through the hoops. Doesn't matter.
Yeah. Bold move, Kate. So.
Hey, that's a wild bunch, but well, you Seth, know, they know what they're doing.
You hopped in the car and drove up to Iowa this past week. So, like, how was that experience being a traveling person again?
It was great. I thought that I might get a little bit weirded out because, like, you know, you got to make maybe like a pit stop, go to the bathroom, at a, you know, go to a gas station, fill up. And I felt fine. I mean, I think around the time I first got the vaccine and started really thinking about, like, okay, I'm going to be just like going out in the world. I'll be wearing a mask and stuff. But especially, you know, driving through rural Missouri, rural Iowa, people just aren't wearing masks.
Great.
And I'm pretty confident that a lot of them are not vaccinated, right? Because at least, you know, like half of people aren't anyways. And so, but it just didn't bother me at all, you know, because I'm like, I mean, I'm wearing one, I'm wearing a mask, and I'm just like passing through, I'm vaccinated, like it's fine. But once I kind of got it in my head that, you know, I'm going to get COVID, like it's going to get into my body, just like a flu would, just like a cold would. And that's the point of the vaccine, right? It's like I at some point need to resume day-to-day life, and there's a really good chance that like this thing's gonna get in me, right? And but that's okay now because not a lot of it is gonna get in there because I'm wearing a mask and I got the vaccine, and well, I'm not going to concerts, I'm not going to movie theaters, you know.
Yeah, it's the same as the flu, it's fine. Right? It's like it's not
same as the flu.
Yeah. It's not really okay because it's still a disease and it can still do a lot of damage, right?
Yeah,
but
also, you've taken the precautions.
Yeah, you've taken the precautions.
You can. Now you go live your life like a normal person and don't let it, you know, destroy.
But you still take precautions, right? You don't do it like a normal person in the sense of like, you know, licking everyone's face you see or any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
that's what normal people do, right?
Yeah, but well, it depends where you are, where you live, but yeah.
Depending on your customs.
Mm-hmm. Right,
whatever those are
the old face licking meet and greet tradition.
So as long as you're, you know, still avoiding those kinds of things and like stuff.
Yeah, I'm not shaking hands with randos, you know, and stuff like that. But and also like if I have the option to do like video calls or phone calls to like have an appointment, because like there's a lot of like telemedicine and stuff like that.
That's also been one of the boons from this thing.
Yeah,
and
especially, you know, like I've been. Like I mentioned a while back in the podcast, you know, I got a psychiatrist appointment set up, and I got a prescription for Ritalin for my ADHD and stuff like that. And I mean, what is the psych evaluation? Like they just ask you stuff.
Yeah.
Right. There's no physical, there's no palpating of your torso or anything like that. Right. Like it's all just talking through stuff so they can figure things out. Like,
I mean,
that
even a lot of primary care is the same deal, you know, where they just ask you like, oh, why are you here? What's going on? And then if you tell them some things, you're like, oh, okay, let's get you sent off to these specialists to get checked out more.
So often, you go to the doctor and the only thing they do is send you somewhere else after asking you three questions. Right? Like that could have happened over the phone, frankly. Mm-hmm. And so that has been a nice benefit of all that. And you know, I will keep doing that because also like I don't want to drive somewhere 20 minutes away, wait for an hour for a doctor to be late, have them ask me a question, and then I drive back home, right? Like I could have just chilled. Mm-hmm. So it's been an interesting shift. And I think – because we were kind of chatting about this before the episode where I think what's – I wanted to make sure we talked about this just as like to put a pin in it for posterity, just to like – capture what this is like so that when we look back on like, hey, you guys, remember that pandemic? what was that like? You know, because I don't know, maybe it's not interesting to just be like, hey, we traveled and it was kind of normal, right? But like, that's kind of a big deal, actually.
I think it's nice. You know what I mean? That's nice to know.
It's
nice to know.
So yeah, that's happening. You guys will talk about studio stuff.
Yeah. Like,
One kind of interesting thing. So Sam was gone for a couple weeks, or a week and a half, which meant that I could go into some programming problems for Crashlands 2. And one of the things we want to work on for Crashlands 2 is we want build mode to be just, I think the industry term is dope as fuck. Okay.
Yep.
So back in original Crashlands, build mode was throw some floors down and then pretty much do whatever you want, and the walls kind of look like
they're
circles.
Like knee high, they're like knee high circle tables.
It was a comment that we got from time to time where somebody would leave a review and they'd be like, I mean, it's kind of cool that I can build a quote base, but like
it doesn't quite look like a base, and it doesn't do anything. You know what I mean?
Like these walls don't look a whole heck of a lot like walls, and also my base is just like a has no. It's like you just see right into it. So one of the things that we really wanted to try to figure out for Crashlands 2 is like, how do we actually have a build mode that feels like you're making a building, like you're building a house in the wilderness or a cabin or whatever. And the thing that we kind of kept coming back to is this idea of roofs.
Yep.
Right? Like if you have a roof, so think about like, you know, when you're playing The Sims, you know, The Sims is all about building a house, right? And you can go outside of the house and you can actually see like there's a roof on the house. And if you zoom out in the neighborhood, like you see, you don't just always see just like into the house, right? So the fact that sometimes there's a visible roof really cements the idea that this is an indoor space. And so Sam and I talked about that. We were like, yeah, roofs. We're going to do roofs. And I was like, okay, I'll work on that while you're gone. And it sounds simple to just say, we just need to get roofs on these buildings. But then you have to answer the question, what's a building? Mm-hmm. And it took me 2 or 3 days of just iterating on that question. Is a building a collection of interconnected walls?
What if you have a porch out front that's got like one of those, you know, fancy walls that sticks out?
Yeah. And how do you know that you're in the building?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because like a building could – like what if there's 3 walls and they're not joined together? Do you put a roof on that? And so what's hard about it is also that players will be building these buildings in completely arbitrary sizes and shapes and configurations. And the game needs to recognize what's a building and what's not a building in a way that the player gets, right? And it also has to happen instantly. So it can't be the case that like every time you put a wall down – we do like a big old recalculation of all 1,000 pieces of construction that you've put down to figure out what parts count as a building and what parts aren't, right? So it has to be optimized. It has to be simple. And I just wrapped it up yesterday. So it's just two weeks of answering these questions. And where we kind of landed was actually, it's not about buildings. It's about rooms.
Yeah.
And a building is a collection of rooms that share structural supports of some kind. And a room is just a fully enclosed space. Okay. So you could actually have like 2 buildings that are connected by a wall. And the wall is not part of either building. It's just a freestanding wall, right? Because it's not part of a room. So, I think what was wild about it is how this is one of those problems that really highlights how different the human brain is from a computer.
Yeah.
Because I think pathfinding is the same way, right? Where if you show a person a simple image of like a map with some obstacles in it, right? And then you'd be like, draw the path that you would take to like get from point A to B. A person's like, yeah, just go like this. And they can instantly do it and they don't think about it at all. Mm-hmm. And they find a really, really good path, right? Doing pathfinding for a computer is fucking hard.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of computation. And the same thing with this building thing, which is if you show a person like a picture of like a map of a bunch of like structures put together, you'd be like, point out the rooms or like circle the part of this that you think like would count as like the main building or something. And they just do it. And then they can't explain necessarily why those things are true.
But while that is true,
they're just obviously true to them.
I mean, yeah, you know? While that's true, that it's obviously true, that person, they can do it instantly. If you take any 2 people and you start putting them into some gray areas, then you actually can be different. It's like the captchas, you know, from Google, where it's like, which one of these things are cars? And then what fraction of people, when they see like the wheel spilling over into the other frame, you know, like some fraction of people are like, yes, that's a car then. And another fraction don't, right?
Yep. I always waffle on those because I'm like, I don't know what they want me to think here.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yep.
Like,
yep.
Is a wheel a car? Right. And then again, like, is a porch a room? Mm-hmm. Or is it indoors or outdoors? Right. But you know, that's all done now. So now we don't have the roofs yet, but we have the prerequisite for the roofs, which is now we know what a building is.
Yeah. The thing that's exciting about that is actually that having the concept of indoors is really the big win for something like this, because that allows you to do a lot of cool stuff where it's like, say there's a thunderstorm and it's like, it's going really hard. You come inside and we can sort of like pull that sound down. So it feels like you're inside.
We can actually make it, we can muffle it. So it sounds like it's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can even do stuff like if we have rain, you can have like the particles of like raindrops hitting on the terrain and stuff. Right. And then, of course, when you walk inside, there won't be – like it'll feel like you are not being rained on, right? Or you could even do interesting things like, as a player, maybe like if you go indoors, then you like build up some kind of like well-rested benefit, mm-hmm. right? So like checking back in at your base or going into an NPC's house or something gives you something, right? But yeah, again, if the game doesn't know what is indoors, then you don't have any of those.
But it does also create a ratcheting fidelity problem, right? Because as soon as you know you're indoors and you can do these things, then you do. And then you have to answer questions like, if someone goes inside but it's raining, right? And because it's a top-down view, not a first-person view, right? Then they still are seeing actually the same scene they saw just a second ago when they were on the other side of the door, right? Where we had covered the screen with rain, right? And but now if we go in, do we just not cover the part of the screen that the house is in mm-hmm. with rain? Like what happens so that it still seems like it's raining outside, but not inside, right? And so now all of a sudden the thing that was already complex in its own way, which was what does it mean to be raining? Like what does that look like, right? Now the question is, what does it mean when you can see the outside and the inside at the same time? It's raining on one part and then not the other.
Yep. Well, I already have answers to all those.
That's beautiful. Good.
Because of the magic of shaders.
And yeah. I'm not saying you don't already have the answers. I'm just new problems.
Now, each of those answers is two more weeks of work apiece. But still,
it's really
these are things we can do.
Yeah. It's really about saying, like, what does this feature actually unlock from a system, so, like, from a general gameplay and system standpoint? And I think this is one of those weird ones that, like, once you could tell what the fuck a building is and when you're inside or not, there's a lot of really cool stuff that opens up. And of course, it's more work, but it's also just like – it's exactly the work that I think would be awesome.
And it is a lot cooler if you can answer all these problems without instancing it, right? Because in a lot of games, you'll walk into a building and then basically screen wipe. Now you're in a new space, right?
It's like and the space is always way bigger than the building was.
Yeah. Well, it's a TARDIS, right? It's like you get in there and it's huge on the inside. And even when it's not, the point is that space inside of that house is actually not inside the house at all, right? It's just a different space that we pretended like you went into, right? Mm-hmm. And in doing that, all of a sudden we have a huge amount of flexibility of how we do things because we don't have to follow the rules of outside when we're mm-hmm. inside, right? But in having the outside and the inside coexist,
having systemic
computational space in the same mm-hmm. state space, where like all the variables are still there and all this kind of stuff, and now they can interact with each other, then it's way more complicated, but also provides way more room for interactions. Like anybody who's played like a Valheim or something, where you can look out the window, and it's raining and things are happening outside, and you can see a creature off in the distance, there's a huge, huge, huge difference in the depth of the simulation, right? If you, or even like Fallout and stuff, right? Because like in Fallout and similar games, most buildings you go into, it's a totally new space. There's a loading screen.
There's a loading screen. Yep.
And things that are outside mostly can't come inside and all of that. It's just very, very different experience.
Yeah. We want a continuous world wherever we can have one, mm-hmm. right? So, so that's been pretty fun. But yeah, it's just one of those weird game dev challenges where, if you're like romanticizing about what it would like to make games and you think, what if I had to spend 2 weeks just answering the question of what's a building, right? Like that's one of those things that you'd have to do. All right, well, let's talk about industry news real quick. I think the one thing to talk about is this Epic versus Apple lawsuit going on. Epic is suing Apple for, I believe, what they're calling anti-competitive practices because of the 30% cut.
It's actually for a bunch of things, but
yeah, well, it's a bunch of stuff.
It's a 30% cut plus their absolute iron grip on what you're allowed to do within the ecosystem,
right?
Because so you force you to use their payment processor, they force you to use to go through their app. You have to adhere to all of their guidelines to get on there in the first place, and they're also saying that many of those guidelines themselves are anti-competitive. You can't do things like in your app tell people send people to your website. Like to mm-hmm. buy things, right? So there's all this stuff that they just don't let you do, and Epic is making the general argument with all these then specific cases that this is anti-competitive because they in effect have a monopoly over this particular market,
right?
Epic, which honestly, I buy their argument 100%. It all feels correct.
And of course, Epic being the company that takes a percentage of your revenue if you use their game engine and make past a certain amount of money. Mm-hmm. That same company,
yeah, but that's a falsy comparison though because because if you think about the way they do that versus the way the App Store does it, right? Because the App Store takes 30% of your money no matter how much or little you make. It's just that's how it works.
Epic's scales up. So if you don't make much, then you just don't pay.
I think you have to make it either $100,000 or $500,000 before they take anything from you. And then they take 5%. Right.
Yeah.
Which
so they're basically saying, like, once you get to past a point where, like, you're okay.
Yeah.
Right. Then we'll start to that's true. That's fair. So some interesting stuff has come out that we wanted to just hit on real quick, which is kind of – we don't want to talk about necessarily the merits of the case or anything like that. It's really just that in the discovery phase of this thing, there's just been a lot of interesting tidbits of information that have spilled out into the public eye.
Many of them, I think, which we're not supposed to, is my understanding. But
but they're out there now.
It did happen.
And so we're going to talk about them. So first off, we found out that Epic was paying – Sony to allow Fortnite to have crossplay with other platforms on PlayStation. So by definition, Sony or by default, Sony says, like, we do not allow crossplay with other platforms. Their stance is kind of to act as though PlayStation is the only game in town, right? And they don't want you talking about or referencing or pointing at other platforms in any way. And I think the business intent of that is to say, like, let's say you wanted to buy Rocket League or something. And Rocket League, let's say, I think Rocket League does have crossplay over PlayStation.
It does, yeah.
So, but just, you know, hypothetically, multiplayer game, and a friend of yours buys it on PlayStation, and you have maybe like you have a PlayStation and you have a PC, right? You're deciding not whether to buy this game, but where to buy this game. Mm-hmm. And it turns out that your friend wouldn't be able to play with you if you bought the PC version, mm-hmm. right? So you'll just buy the PlayStation version, right? So it's kind of their way of pushing people into their ecosystem instead of elsewhere. But as with all things, there's a price on that principle, and Epic paid it. And that's what allowed them to have crossplay for Fortnite. Pretty interesting, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, I think but the way that they did it was that because they had to negotiate what that actually would mean, you know? And I think what it came down to was that Epic had to separately track, like, purchases made in PlayStation, and like had to track for all their users that made Epic accounts, which ones made those through PlayStation, and like and all this kind of stuff, so that they could basically attribute how many players were coming from PlayStation, where they were buying things. It was still the case that, as I understood it, that you couldn't buy stuff on another store, even though they had crossplay and all of that. And you had the same account. If you bought stuff in another store, you couldn't use those V-Bucks, is what they're called, like in PlayStation and vice versa, right? So it has like a closed, like a weirdly closed market where there's some – so they had to like kind of carefully dissect what actually was and was not allowed to spill over. And then they had to pay basically a licensing fee. So it was like per player. And what they're actually doing is they were charging Epic for players that came from PlayStation and played on other platforms. That was actually what was happening. Mm-hmm. So the idea, I guess, being that in effect, PlayStation was the thing that caused them, those players, to exist for Fortnite. And therefore, any money generated by them, Sony was supposed to take a piece, right?
Which is crazy.
But also think about how much fucking web infrastructure you need to track.
No, I mean, crazy on every level. Like
it's a huge amount of work for both Sony and Epic to track this, and it's honestly hard to say whether anybody benefited. Players,
well, I think
Sony
they do. Well, yeah, players definitely don't. But Sony, I think Sony and Epic did, because if you saw they also had their revenue numbers come out per platform, and by a wide margin, PlayStation is making the most money.
Well, I wouldn't say Epic did, though, right? Because Epic had to do a ton of work to set this whole thing up, right? And like if crossplay was just allowed.
I'm not saying relative to being allowed to do it in the first place. I'm saying relative to not being allowed to do it. Mm-hmm. And then on Sony's end, like Sony mostly actually just is allowed to audit. They didn't have to build any of the tech. They just got to say, here's what you don't get to do, right? So they didn't have to do fucking jack shit. They just got to say, here are the rules. And then Epic had to go spend probably $5 million on infrastructure, right, to build out the mechanisms to be able to do that. And then they just have to audit. And then basically Sony presumably has auditing rights where they can basically say, at any moment, we need to see your books to make sure that you're paying us as much money as you're supposed to.
Yeah. So this
I think we probably can't talk about it, but we we were looking at a long time ago at a relationship with Sony.
4 years ago, probably 5 years ago.
Yeah, maybe more than that even.
And yeah, this kind of thing sort of.
Yeah, this kind of thing off. Was in there. So yeah, yeah. I'm not sure if we're allowed to get into it, so I won't get into any details. But there was a line in the contract that made us really nervous, and it was along these kinds of lines. Mm-hmm. And the long story short, that is the reason that we didn't end up on PlayStation then, and yeah. why we've been nervous ever since. And now seeing this, that because right. nobody it's knew like this, right? This is yeah. this came out in the discovery that. That this because there was this period of time when Sony suddenly started being like, oh yeah, we're gonna start allowing crossplay, right? What we didn't know was that behind the scenes,
and it was only certain games that had
only certain games. That was because they were negotiating the terms of that, and basically how much money you would have to pay Sony as the developer or publisher to be able to do it
by basically generating players for your game on PlayStation, and then allowing those players to spend money elsewhere, right, for this on the same account. So that's it's. It's pretty wild. Like, and I think what's kind of
platform overreach.
It is, but the funny thing about this is like it turns out that mobile makes up 7% of Fortnite's revenue. And like this Sony thing is so much more egregiously anti-competitive than anything Apple is doing. But Epic is not going to sue Sony because so much of their money comes from PlayStation.
they can't afford to sue Sony, right? But I think part of this is that by trying to shift the whole winds of the industry, right? It becomes as they knock down each piece of the puzzle, right? Mm-hmm. Then it becomes harder and harder and harder for Sony to sit in its corner and be like, "Yeah, everything we're doing is fine.
Everything we're doing is totally fine and not anti-consumer at all, or anti-developer." So that's been a kind of interesting thing. We'll kind of see what shakes out with that. The second thing, which is kind of an interesting note, is there was a period where when Fortnite got pulled from the mobile stores was when Epic patched in. Secretly and flipped the switch to turn on their own payment processing, which was you would buy V-Bucks directly from Epic instead of through the App Store or Google Play or whatever. And to encourage that, they basically framed it to players as, hey, since we're just charging you directly, there's no 30% cut for us, which means we can charge you less. Mm-hmm. Right, like we can charge you just the difference, so you'll save money, and we'll save money, and we're just cutting out the middleman, right?
Yeah, and this was happening in app, but there were many examples before this for other apps and games of trying to do the same thing, where they would lead you outside the app, and they would basically tell you in the app, hey, if you buy these same things outside of here, like on our website or whatever. Then it's cheaper.
Yeah. And what's kind of interesting about it was then the follow-up report, which was that the number of purchases went up, but not enough to offset the reduction in price, and they lost money. Mm-hmm. Which actually – so we saw this when we reduced the price of Crashlands on Steam from $14.99 to $9.99. Mm-hmm. And actually in our case, purchase numbers didn't really move at all. Like the same number of people were buying the game as before – so we just suddenly were making 2/3 as much money, which is
looked like it was less. It actually looks like we had fewer.
I think we did a few purchases.
Yeah. Oh yeah, actually, yeah, our number of sales.
Yeah, it's hard to tell because it wasn't a direct A/B test, so it's fuzzy, right? But at best, it was the same, but it looked like it might have been worse than that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so what's kind of weird about this is that especially nowadays, because games are digital goods that don't have inventory, right? So every additional copy of a game sold does not carry a variable cost with it. Right, so the price of a game is totally arbitrary. The mm-hmm. price of an in-app purchase item is totally arbitrary. It doesn't need to be $60 for a AAA game. It could be $6. It could be $300. We've all just kind of stuck to 60 because that's kind of what it was back when they were shipped in boxes, mm-hmm. right? And what's weird about it is that it's an inelastic demand curve because as that price moves up and down. The demand doesn't change in a proportional way. Once people want the thing, then they're going to buy it kind of whether it's $10 or $7, whether it's 50 or 60, right? Like, there's definitely going to be a curve there, right? Like if something is $10 instead of 60, that's a big enough difference that maybe you'll see a different behavior. I don't know. But if you're wiggling things around by 20% up or down, it doesn't seem like
you have to basically hit different sort of like conceptual tiers, but all those exist in context, though, right? Because the reason that $60 for so long, was the AAA price point was, as Seth noted, because that's what it was on a shelf roughly. But that wasn't even true. Like when we were growing up, you know, back in the 90s when we were buying games, they were probably $40 or something like that, or 30. I can't remember what they were, but they weren't $60 at the time, right? But the price on that shelf has been going up kind of slowly, right? And then once they went digital, when they priced the thing, they couldn't have a different price digitally because it would make it hard to sell the physical ones, mm-hmm. right? Because they would disincentivize buying the physical goods.
And of course, their retail partners would not be pleased.
Yeah, exactly. So the reason that digital versions of games cost what they do is because the physical ones did, right? And the physical ones, of course, include all the costs that go into physical of distribution and all the other stuff too. And now as they've been raising prices, because of course they have to over time, because it gets more and more expensive to do things because inflation, other things, the games themselves are getting more complicated. So they do get more expensive over time, but they have to all AAA studios are playing a game where they're trying to increase their prices as much as they think people will be willing to pay, but not be the first one necessarily to hit like a new tier, you know, like to go like
$70, for example.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like once you get like six, when you go from 60 to 65, people are like, whatever, it's the same. That's the same number, right? You go from 60 to 70 and people will be like, what the fuck? Like last time I bought a game, it was $60, right? And weirdly, because I think it's probably because like movies do the same thing, actually books do the same thing, right? Like you buy a novel, like every fucking novel you buy is like $15, right? Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter if it's twice as long, twice as good. Written by five people at once. Like, it doesn't matter, right? And it's the same deal with movies. Like a movie has a price. You buy it for, like, I don't know what it is these days anymore because it's all streamed and other stuff, right? But back in the day,
you
don't buy it anymore, right? Yeah, but back in the day, that when you would buy it for more, it was because it was on Blu-ray, right?
Like quality was better, basically.
Yeah, you were buying the higher cost of the physical item. It had nothing to do with how much it cost to make the movie or whatever. And so games have slipped into that same category, but that never made sense. It never made sense that was how you paid for those things, that was uncoupled with the cost of making the thing, right? And so games are in this weird space where they basically inherited the physical retail way of selling things. And once they went digital, that changed a lot because now if you look at like a marketplace like mobile or Steam, games are priced at fucking everywhere across the board, right?
Yep.
But the ones that are still latched to physical – are like stuck with these like tiers of things they have to make jumps and the whole market has to do it at once, right? It's weird.
Yeah. It's a weird ecosystem. Yeah. And because it's not physical, then it's all psychological what's happening. And so then kind of the last little bit, we may actually not get to questions this episode, because a lot of really interesting stuff has happened. So we'll make up for it next episode if we don't. But the last bit of industry stuff from this epic thing is there was revealed a spreadsheet of data of how much Epic paid indie studios for the games that they brought in to be the free game. Because Epic every week has a free game and they pay the studio for rights to, you know, distribute that game for free. And what was kind of telling about it was that there was an enormous range in how much Epic paid studios, ranging from, you know, $50,000 all the way up to millions of dollars. And the outcome of bringing any of those games in was completely uncorrelated to how many downloads that game brought, how many players that game brought. There was no real connection, right? So you might have a game that like they paid very little for that brought in tons of players, and a game that they paid a lot for that brought in almost no players. And so I think that speaks to two things. One is nobody has any idea how well a game is going to do,
right? Yep.
And this is something that we hear from Valve all the time, where Valve says like, look, we have data on like every PC game sale from the past 20 years.
Yeah.
And we have no idea what games are going to succeed, right? It's all a gamble and you don't really know, right? But on the flip side of that, it also kind of shows that indie developers often sell themselves short.
Oh, 100%.
You know, they have a great product that has proven it the test of time in the market. People still love it. Maybe it's a 10-year-old game. Maybe it's a 5-year-old game. And to have a company like Epic, you know, with the war chest that they have, come to you and say, hey, we'll give you $50,000 to bring this to our platform. To just accept that, just like at face value and not negotiate that up. I mean, negotiate that thing, you guys.
You have to negotiate every single thing that comes up.
Yeah.
And we talked about this. We talked about our quarterly, which is about this idea of compounding interest. And one of the weirdest ones, I think, is this is bringing the concept of negotiation into everything you do, both as a studio, as a person, whatever else, because it's not about winning in any given on any given particular deal or like getting some extreme win in some particular circumstance. It's about the fact that by negotiating, you're going to be getting literally sometimes just like 2% extra stuff, you know, just like
it's like the cross-platform strategy, you know.
Yep.
It's like on any one platform, who knows what's going to happen. And maybe on all platforms you don't do very well, but you're on all the platforms though. So like collectively.
Yeah.
So you're doing well.
So over time, if you just keep on doing this, then you're literally just doing better. And sometimes
and it's the cheapest work you can do with the highest payoff because it's just asking questions and saying a few things.
Yeah.
And then you just suddenly have three times as much money or whatever.
Yeah, this is what like this
drives me mad. We've sent emails that have been worth emails. Oh. Just an email with text in it, right? That have been worth months of runway.
Mm-hmm.
Because we just asked,
and they're not crazy. I think that's the thing people get. They're like, oh my god, how do you word it? And oftentimes you could just ask, and it's the craziest thing to say that you can just ask someone, be like, could we just have more though? And then make it their problem to figure out how much more. And then they'll come back and be like, yeah, here's some more, you know.
Yeah. If you're just like, well, this is a bit low. That's all you really have to say because. Yeah. I mean, you could. There are a lot of negotiating tactics. You could take it a lot farther, right? But at baseline, I think what makes people uncomfortable is like being perceived as greedy, being perceived as like burdening the other party who's ungrateful, money,
right? If someone shows up with an offer, right?
Or being worried that the offer will go away.
Yeah, the fact is, like, negotiating is just part of it. Everybody wants to do what's best for themselves, right? And like if somebody's coming to you saying like, hey, we want your product, it's because they think that it's valuable. They want that content mm-hmm. for their platform and they think it's going to benefit their platform. So well, you have something that they want, your game, and they have something you want, money. So, yep. So right. You can find a middle ground so that they still get the game and you get as much money as you can. And that's totally expected.
But the key
fair
is the fact that there is no way to assign a absolute value right to a deal. It's not possible. You can't say that this value is actually worth this. When we're talking about a game, when you're talking about things like I want to buy a factory that makes widgets that's made exactly this much money for the past 5 years, it's like, yeah, obviously you can attach a value to that, right? When you're talking about – you want to like – so like with an Epic deal, you're saying, okay, I don't know how many players you even have. I don't know how many people – I don't know how many people, if this game is available for free, will get it for free. Don't know what's going to happen. Of those people, I don't know what fraction will even play it. So now you as a person giving up access to the game, you know nothing. You also don't know what's going to be the impact of all these free keys, all these free players on the other platforms that the game is already on, right?
Yep.
You don't know any of that, and neither does – and the other person knows a whole bunch of other stuff, right? But they also don't know for sure. Like they know how many users they have, but they don't know how many years game is going to bring in, right?
Yep.
They don't know how well your game is done on other platforms, right? So basically there's a huge asymmetry in both directions.
Everybody's just doing their best.
Well, it's not even that. They're just making shit up. You're just making it up, right? So when it comes to the negotiation part, when you're trying to evaluate what you think you're trying to get, just remember that you're making it up. So that number can be anything. It can be as hot. Just keep on pushing it up. It can be anything, right? You just need a way to explain it, right?
Within reason.
Yeah. But those explanations can be anything, right? It can be as simple as like, oh, well, I'm worried about what the impact of this will be on the other platforms. I'm worried it might knock sales down by having all these free copies out, right? And so you can say, I just need more to offset that risk that I'm worried about,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah. There's a lot
which
of angles.
Which is very fair.
Yeah. So 99% of the time, they'll either be like, you know, oh, yeah, that makes sense. Or they'll say, actually, here's some information that you didn't have before that we have that we didn't tell you.
Yeah.
That speaks to this point.
It's all a game of like you trying to get as much information as you can. Like, and if you're playing the game in the way that's fun, where like you're doing it in good faith and all of that, then it's basically there's just really interesting sort of fact finding and trying to understand what the other person's goals are.
It ends up being a collaborative endeavor when it's good.
Yeah. It's not adversarial.
It's not adversarial at all, which is actually awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think there's also kind of a freeing aspect to just being like, I want money and I like it.
Yep.
I like having it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can just admit that, cause like having more of it is better than having less of it, right? I think we could all get behind that, no matter who you are. And it's not gross or slimy or weird to say that.
Mm-hmm.
And to do what you need to do with these kinds of deal negotiations to get more for yourself.
Yeah, I think every indie studio should read the Never Split the Difference book. That's the one. Just before you decide not to negotiate anything or sign a deal, just please read that fucking book. It'll take a couple hours and you will just start getting twice as much money from everything forever. So, you know, as far as like a $12 investment or 15, I guess, probably for that book.
It's 15 because it's a book, but yep.
Yeah, which is basically how once we actually started trying to do business deals and negotiate with people, we took that time, we read these things. And we basically have been doing this practice, right? And the consequence of it is that we are literally basically doing twice as well as we otherwise would have been up to this point. So
that's by sending some fucking emails. Like that's the thing. I'm like, oh my God, all the work we do as game devs.
Yeah, you spend years making a game.
And people are like, oh, I don't want to send that email. What?
Send the email.
Send the email.
Maybe. Be an advocate for yourself.
Yeah.
You know, it's all that it is. So, all right. Well, sorry we weren't able to get to questions this week. But, you know, Sam was gone for a couple of weeks and a lot of stuff happened.
Yeah.
So I think – are you guys down to – we can commit to like next episode. We can just do – we can do a question blitz.
Heck yes.
Sure, yeah.
Okay.
So if you got questions, load them up. Load them up.
Load up the questions, podcast.bscotch.net. Upvote the ones you want to hear about and we will burn through possibly up to 3 questions next episode.
How many can we get through in an hour, you know, up to 3.
Up to 3. All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this week. We'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Koster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, go to podcast.bscotch.net, where we have links to the Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the archives. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.